The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why do you prefer the term global warming to climate change?
Climate change is a really soft, vague term, and you know, and there's a real difference in the definitions. Global warming is the measurable global heating that's already happened to this planet as a result of human emissions, greenhouse gases. And climate change is a result of global warming, and it's manifest in severe weather changes, you know, freezing winters, scorching droughts, bigger storms, floods, these kind of events that are amplified and made more common by global warming. But global warming is the parent phrase for a bunch of reasons. For one thing, it assigns blame. The implication is clearly it's a result of human activity. And when I say global warming, I assume some responsibility when I use that phrase.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Doug Peacock about his latest book, which has a really long title, In the Shadow of the Sabretooth, a renegade naturalist considers global warming, the first Americans, and the terrible beasts of the Pleistocene. What prompted you to tackle such a huge subject?
The cardinal issue of my generation is clearly global warming. I felt I needed to address that in some way. Global warming itself is not a pleasant story, and it's truly a bummer story. I didn't want to write a bummer book, and I wondered if I could write around it in some constructive way. And it occurred to me that, you know, we've had two Homo sapiens, our own species, who have been on Earth for almost 200,000 years, have experienced two periods of global warming. The present one, much more extreme than the one that happened in the Pleistocene, and the one that happened in North America about 15,000 years ago. And all of a sudden, the atmosphere began to heat up. The causes are unknown, and the glaciers began to melt. The sea rose by some 350 feet. And people suddenly showed up in North America. And I wondered if I could explore the former one and look for constructive parallels, not literary ones. It actually turns out it's more parable than it is parallels. There's just not enough data to make direct comparison, but it was a time of incredible adaptation in human life. And you know, the Americas are really interesting because by 40,000 years ago, every continent in the world had been occupied with the exception of Antarctica and North and South America. You know, why did it take people with a boat sitting on the South China Sea 40,000 years to make it from the Asian coast over to North America? And that's what I explore in my book. There's not a lot of hard archaeology. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is the books that have been produced by professionals really don't reach into speculative ground at all. And there's just huge gaping questions that beg an answer, at least a guess, as to what kept people out of North America, and what put down the megafauna, which are generally defined as animals over at least 100 pounds. We had lots of them back in the Pleistocene. They all went extinct pretty much at the same geological instance. And so that remains an incredible mystery. No doubt, global warming, climate change, and human activity are the bedrock reasons. But in what proportions are mixed is still, it's a formidable mystery. Fascinating.
This book is a mixture of information you got from all the other books you read, your own personal experience, and you also make up some scenarios that might have happened. So you do a little bit of creative writing as well.
I have dusty degrees in geology and anthropology, mainly courses taken almost back in the Pleistocene. But I read, and I've read every piece of archaeological literature, whether it's an academic paper or a book. And, you know, I was trained as an archaeologist. You know, I was working on a National Science Foundation grant as an archaeologist by the time I was 18. So, I knew the field in general. Some of my closest mentors were archaeologists. And I don't feature dueling archaeologists in that book. And I challenge pretty much, there's nothing, I take at face value. And, you know, I have, the one edge I have on all of the archaeologists is I've spent 50 years exploring the same territories, you know, from the Arctic Sea to Mexico that this adventure takes place in.
Well, before we go too much farther, let's set the stage. Tell us where we are in time with these Clovis people, the pre-Clovis people, and these big animals.
Yeah, the late Pleistocene is our last ice age, you know, and the last phases of the Pleistocene, it's an epoch called the Wisconsin, and it's you know, that's where most of the human history unfolded. But briefly, it goes like this. Our species has only been on Earth about 196,000 years that we know of. We evolved in Africa. We stayed in Africa until about 70,000 years ago. 73,000 years ago was the biggest volcanic eruption in 2.2 million years happened in Sumatra. Mount Toba erupted. And there ensued a nuclear volcanic winter. And the global temperatures dropped, they believe, by 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit, you know. And human beings, geneticists, are now doing this because we don't really have direct paleontological records of people from that period. But geneticists think the human population might have gone down to low thousands. Right after that, modern humans, crossed the Red Sea and headed east. The Neanderthal people were in Europe at that time, 50,000 years ago or 60,000 years ago, but they headed east into Asia, and they came up, and of course, across the Red Sea, they had to have maritime technology, boats. And by 60,000 years ago, they show up in Australia. And that means, you know, crossing open ocean where you can't see anything but water. And, you know, that's fairly sophisticated. And it implies the use of, you know, net fishing technology and really sophisticated marine, you know, navigational skills. And at the same time, modern humans are up on the China Sea and off Japan and all over. But they don't get to North America for another 25,000 years. And that's, you know, and that's a big question. You know, why not? By 40,000 years ago, modern humans that pioneered pretty much every habitat in the world, including the Arctic, the oceans, the deserts. They've been everywhere, with the exception of North America. And we don't see any sign of humans until about 15,000 years ago. And a corridor opened between the ice sheets. And all of a sudden, the elephant hunters that we call Clovis, because they really seem to specialize in mammoth, just exploded across the continent. And I mean exploded. I make an argument in the book that they probably came out of the corridor and showed up in Montana. And that's probably where the Clovis projectile point, which is not just an arrowhead. I mean, this is a 6 or 7 inch long spearhead, and I've had the privilege of holding one. And it transcends function. It's a piece of art, you know, it's a piece of beauty. And, you know, archaeologists theorize they were used as, you know, totems and sacred exchanges and things like that. But, you know, you pick up one of these things, rabbits never come to mind, you know, not even bison. You know, these guys had elephant hunting on their minds. And within 200 years, maybe even less, that signature artifact, that iconic Clovis projectile point, as it's called, it's long and it's got a little groove on either side of the base, and, you know, it's unmistakable. It shows up from New York to Panama, from Washington State to Florida. And if you look at all the radiocarbon dates, it seems to show up everywhere at once. You know, there's no gradient from north to south or east to west or anything like that. And it hangs around for about 200 years. And by 300 years, it suddenly disappears, along with the last fossil record of the megafauna, you know, the animals that go extinct. We are now in what they call the sixth great extinction. We're losing many more species than we lost in the Pleistocene extinction. But the Pleistocene extinction was spectacular because all of these great, huge animals died out at the same geologic sec. I mean, there's mammoth, there's mastodon, there's a Pleistocene lion, you know, that was twice as big as the African variety and had a huge cranium, so it was probably a pride hunting. And saber-tooth of a couple different times. And most of all, there was a gigantic bear called a short-faced bear. And this guy, flaring his broad nostrils, as he no doubt did, and stand 15 feet tall. I've had the privilege of handling a museum specimen, and he could probably smell a mammoth or a giant sloth carcass from 20 miles away. And I think that's ultimately what kept the Americas, especially the lower 48, from being colonized.
Now, we're talking about a disappearance of animals and a climate shift that's different than the dinosaur extinction, right?
Oh, yeah. The dinosaurs, no doubt there's a giant crater and there is a extraterrestrial event, probably a comet, something, or a huge asteroid hitting the Earth. Much like a volcano blowing, you know, those extinctions are related to geologic events like an asteroid or a comet hitting the Earth or a huge volcano like the one I mentioned in Sumatra. The Pleistocene extinction was a combination of global warming and human activity. And that's the one conclusion you can come at the very end of this book, that those two factors, climate change and human activity, are a timeless, deadly formula for extinction.
This cycle that we're in right now, this global warming cycle, what makes it different from the one that you are hypothesizing about? Is it the speed with which it's coming on?
Yeah, there's several things. I mean, this one is caused by human beings. And it is happening so fast. And everybody talks glibly about, you know, the next 100 years. Our children and grandchildren their lives could be severely curtailed and affected in 15 or 20 years. Nobody knows how fast this is coming. Climate scientists are always understating the case, you know, and then they realize that, you know, they've missed a couple compensating factors, and it's all happening faster than anybody predicted. And, you know, I keep up on the literature. My book is not about, you know, there's a lot of technical literature, and my book is not about that. My book is 90% of a chronicle of what takes place in the Pleistocene, but modern-day global warming is the mammoth in the room at all times.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Doug Peacock about In the Shadow of the Sabretooth, a renegade naturalist considers global warming, the first Americans, and the terrible beasts of the Pleistocene. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the importance of wilderness and hear a passage from the book. Don't go away. Thank you. In relationship to global warming, you write that wilderness will buy us the kind of time geoengineering never could or will. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's simply that my belief is that, you know, that which evolves doesn't persist without the conditions that created it, that gave rise to it. All our evolution, all our human evolution took place in habitats whose remnants today we call wilderness. You know, we have the same brain today that we had 35,000 years ago. And, you know, that the thing we so value, or the human mind, human consciousness, was evolved hunting great big animals with spears, you know, while looking in the bushes for the saber tooth and the short-faced bear. And I just think it's a risky proposition to think we're going to drift into the future with some kind of technological fix, which I certainly do not believe is possible. Our best bet is to hedge our bets and continue to fight to save wilderness, just in case we need it again. You know, Ed Abbey talked about this a long time ago. He says, you know, the only thing I see around worth saving is wilderness. And I feel the same way today. And, you know, my whole life, I mean, I'm not primarily a writer. I try to save wild habitats. And, you know, I work in Africa and British Columbia. And in British Columbia, in the last 20 years, we, and I mean, you know, two organizations, one of which I co-founded, we've saved about almost 20 million acres. Now, that's like 10 Yellowstone parks. It's a lot of country. By working with native peoples and, you know, establishing homelands that, you know, so that's my real work. And so that's where I place my bets is, there's some interesting thinkers around, like James Lovelock, you know, who predicts that the Earth is basically going to be uninhabitable, that Berlin is going to be as hot as Baghdad, and Atlanta is going to be a kuzu city, that global warming is going to bake agriculture out of South Asia altogether and, you know, banish the crops to the gulags of Siberia. And that the conflict between the Chinese and the Russians, nuclear war, a bottleneck. He predicts that out of our, now we got 7 billion people, that, you know, 6 out of 7 people will perish. He doesn't know when, and neither do I, but, you know, in the next 20 to 80 years. You know, what is the emotional ambience if you were the only survivor out of a family of 7? We don't know how to think about these things.
No, very grim. Well, there's a passage that I'd like you to read that addresses some of that.
Yes, the passage I'm going to read here, it's right at the end of the last archaeological paragraph in the book. I'll just simply read, because the book really ends then, and what I'm going to read is what I had to say after I finished writing the book. And I'm talking about the Clovis projectile point. I just say, that iconic Clovis projectile point, simple, luminous, so skillfully sculpted that some think it was intended for totemic exchanges and religious ceremonies, was the first in a long line of cold, deadly American weapons, as sleek and beautiful as a Patriot missile. Today, we face change in a magnitude of global warming that will make the extinctions of the late Pleistocene seem like small potatoes. Not even the grizzly bear will survive the worst-case scenario for today's human-induced climate changes. The fate of the two-legged omnivore in the 22nd century is itself up for grabs. Our perception of what urgently lies in our own vital interest for human survival is barely coming into focus, and it appears to be very late in the climate change game. Scientists believe we are reaching the tipping point in global warming. The polar ice caps melt, then the Amazonian rainforest collapses, which leads to a Siberian permafrost thaw, releasing methane that gives us an increased 6 degrees Celsius, etc. Where, and that's all in parentheses there, where natural systems experience sudden, rapid, and irreversible change. Scientists are constantly playing catch-up when it comes to underestimating the magnitude and consequences of a warming climate. It's not surprising the public doesn't seem to get it. Governments have no such excuse. They mandate the use of styrofoam cups, not reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. And even if they did act, it may be too late for governmental bailouts and technological fixes. The problem is not simple greenhouse gas concentration. It's a way of life whose time is over. Endless growth is impossible in a world of finite resources. The hardest truth from the hardest thinkers is that we must walk away from 12,000 years of stable climate and 10,000 years of civilization to find a new way of living. Our version of human life on Earth is ending, and it's useless to pretend we can hang on to our current lifestyle. We'll have to give up much of what we consider central to our usual daily lives. I'm not looking forward to it, and mostly see severe global cutting back as a painful and sometimes ugly process. There are no benign economic solutions, and corporations, driven by the myth of continual growth, are unlikely to arrive on a doorstep of social responsibility. Technology is what has empowered us to bring on devastating climatic changes within a mere 250 years, which under natural cycles would have taken hundreds of thousands of years. Might we make a similar but much smaller claim for the iconic Clovis projectile point, contributing to the demise of the megafauna on an identical timetable? I find this 250 years interesting because it's also the amount of time that that Europeans have had a firm toehold over the North American continent, and it marks also the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And that's the same 250 years as when Clovis show up and the megafauna go up. It's just curious. Now I have to continue my reading. Despite misplaced hope for global sunshades and other temporary fixes to buy some time, high technology will not bail us out of this one.
So what should an ordinary person do?
I think the most important thing is the simple realization, that humans are not in charge. I've fought all my life for social justice. You know, I brought Martin Luther King to the University of Michigan in 1963. But social justice is not enough. And I published this book with a very lefty press intentionally, trying to get my friend Alexander Coburn and people like Noam Chomsky to really think about the planet. Because you can have all the social justice on if we achieve the perfect world, we're not going to have a planet on which to practice it. And, you know, the realization that we live on this planet of finite resources, and it cannot support 7 billion human beings living at any level of comfort, especially, you know, we are so insulated, you know, by our clever technology and our material comfort. That we see global warming and those kinds of changes as something that happens distantly and incrementally to strangers. You know, we imagine global warming affecting people living on an atoll or the people of Bangladesh. Yeah, I think humans are capable of going either way. I think we are capable of tremendous empathy. And if anything is going to save us, it's going to be the empathy for the grandchildren of those strangers living halfway across the world, because this is eventually going to happen to all of us. And we're all in it together, and it's that empathy for strangers, I think, ultimately will save us.
But what specific changes should I make, mm-hmm. should everyone make in their
Well, we need to do everything Bill McKibben says. We need to back down, and we have to stop putting stuff in the air that makes the planet heat.
How does that translate into someone who needs to go to work and lives 10 miles from work? You're talking about very, very large changes for a lot of people, and how do we do that one person at a time?
If we could continue to expand this dialogue and this realization that it is upon us, I think that discourse will filter out eventually. It'll take governments and corporations I know, and it sounds hopeless, but all we can do is fight like hell. And living simple as you can, making the little sacrifices, doing what everybody knows is right. You know, eat a little lower on the food chain. You know, walk, don't drive. All of this stuff is important. And the most important thing is not to feel powerless. You know, what you do is important and has consequences. And, you know, whether it's educating countless people about the terrible reality of the world or growing your own vegetables, collectively, it has to be big enough to cause a wave. And I know we're capable of doing it. You know, there's a lot of people out there already speaking about this, and they're right. And the only thing I have to add is I think it's happening even faster than we think it is. If one of those ice sheets in Antarctica breaks loose, like the Ross Ice Sheet, that's 12 feet of ocean rise in a week everywhere. New York subways, San Francisco, India, Bangladesh. I mean, that'll get people's attention. And I can't help but notice it. You know, during catastrophes, people behave a little more decently. And tragically, it may take an event like that to get people's attention.
We get so focused on what we have to do for
it's really easy.
Today that we're yeah. not thinking about what's coming in the future. And we've had decades of people giving predictions that bad things are going to happen.
You know, we were evolved to look for the saber tooth in the bush, not to look for this kind of stuff, you know, this incremental heating that it happens so slow you can't even see it. And people are not certain about sea rise at all, but it's coming. And, you know, we evolved with spears in our hands, looking out for tigers and bears in the bushes. And this is just as real a threat. It is the beast of our time. And that's why I wrote this book. Once that cloud comes over with the long fangs, we will get it. And I think my greatest fear is that it's coming sooner than later. It's, you know, I have two children, and that's what I think about.
Doug Peacock lives in Immigrant, Montana, and spends considerable time in the Sonoran Desert, southeast Utah, and with the grizzlies of Glacier and Yellowstone National Parks. You'll find more information about him and his books at our blog, located at mtpr.org/twq. And while you're there, click over and like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.